Members, I'm going to give just a few more minutes. So that I've sent the pages out to see if they can find some of our other members. I'm not sure what's going on this morning, but I'm going to give it about... the nurses are here. And the medical professionals. we'll give it a couple more minutes, and then we'll start without them. And we have the... just to make sure I cover my bases, we have 12th grade students from Princeton High School here. And appreciate you joining us and scoping out the jobs of tomorrow. In the next couple of years, we might want to give up these jobs.
Talking about it this afternoon.
Yeah. So, but glad to have you here. We typically are more on time and... I'm not entirely... Well, we typically only start 5 minutes late. It looks like it's going to be 10 today. And this committee tries to deal with workforce issues and economic development and technology, biosciences and sciences and engineering. So today we're going to talk about how we can improve our workforce programs. And... I think I'll just get started here, and hopefully they'll come in. I'm going to ask Commissioner McElroy to come to the witness stand for a few moments or some questions. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner McElroy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You did not get a chance to really finish any comments that you might have wanted to add to your presentation the other day. And if there are some that you'd like to add before I open it up for questions, otherwise I've got a few questions that we could just start off with, too.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I have a number of people with me today, including Bonnie Elsie, who's the Director of our Workforce Development Division, and representatives from the Workforce Center Association, and I see Minsky representatives in the audience. And Mr. Chairman, I also recall that Deb Serum had just finished presenting the accountability measures based on Representative Norton's work in the last session, and she's available if you have additional questions for her.
I think we'll ask her to come down. She can come down with you. Representative Norton is here, or she can come down right after you're done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In terms of further comments, as I said last week, we were pleased with the level of cooperation we got from the auditor, as we always do. We found the recommendations helpful. As I understood their recommendations better, in the letter we wrote, we disagreed with a finding where we thought they were calling on us to distribute all of the money for small layoffs in a competitive process, which we had concerns about because of the way the Workforce Center Association or Workforce Center areas depend on that dollars to serve on a formula basis. What they had intended was that the non-Workforce Center recipients, the providers like Teamsters Service Bureau and others, that those grants should be more competitive, and we agree with that. And so we found it to be a very helpful process. And we would, so I don't have any further comments other than to say we welcome your questions. If there are ones that I need technical assistance with, I'll call on Ms. Elsie to help, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you. One of the other parts, and I'll start out the question, one of the other recommendations they made was gathering some people together, Governor's Workforce Council, to try and fill the gaps, I think is the way they phrased it. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you like to comment on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the challenge that they pointed out was greater need and opportunity for collaboration between programs like adult basic education, community college, workforce centers, and others. And they're already, and we agree with that, and there are already things going on to help address those gaps. We have a program for which we got funding from the Joyce Foundation and some additional federal funds called Fast Track that is aimed at better connecting principally adult basic education with the higher education and the workforce. And you may recall, Senator Clark passed a bill last session calling on us to create four, what she called big picture collaborations that included Head Start, you know, so starting with preschool, K-12, adult basic education, community and technical colleges, our workforce centers, and the workforce center programs. And those four are underway, one in the St. Cloud area, one in southeastern Minnesota, two, I believe, in the metropolitan area. And they're intended to be year-long pilots of ways to better connect those programs. We've also been increasing the extent to which, and the Workforce Center Association may want to comment on this also. We all know that the customers have multiple needs and that we need to work with them across multiple programs. So we agree. Governor's Workforce Development Council already has underway a program to better understand the return on investment of workforce programs. Brian Lindsay is also here. They recently received grant funding to help with filling some gaps as it applies to green industries. So we agree that seamlessness, that we're not at seamless yet, and that's a goal.
Well, Commissioner McElroy, you just mentioned three or four people. I'm not sure if you meant that they should participate with the Governor's Workforce Council. If they so are the ones that we asked to take a look at that and try and figure that out, because I have to be honest, I think you need as close to a third party, disinterested party, to kind of mediate across the boundaries. I know one of the members here tried to get ABE a little bit more involved. I know I've tried to get some people more involved, and really felt like a turf battle. Are you comfortable with the idea of the Governor's Workforce, or would you think, or could you suggest some other third party?
Mr. Chairman, we think the Governor's Workforce Council is an excellent body to do that work. They have representatives from early childhood education, K-12, workforce center people, our agency, MNSCU, University of Minnesota, are all at the table in that group. The one group that I'm not aware is very involved is adult basic education. I suppose they are through the Minnesota Department of Education. And we continue to invite them to participate.
So the only group that you think might be more need to be added to that is to assure that somehow or another AB adult basic ed is in that mix.
Mr. Chairman, if I could invite Brian Lindsley to come down. He's the executive director of the Governor's Workforce Development Council, and he's works more closely with all the members of the council, and I think knows the extent to which Minnesota Department of Education represents ABE, and he'd be better qualified, if that's okay with you.
And then we've got a couple of questions.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
My name is Brian Lindsley, Executive Director of the Governor's Workforce Development Council.
Could you, I'm going to assume that you read the report. It seemed pretty obvious. To me, it's one of the more glaring parts, is that there doesn't seem to be as much collaboration across groups, particularly trying to figure out a way to fill the gaps. Could you comment on that and who you think might be best suited to be added to your workforce council, or the governor's workforce council, or a group to take a look at that?
Sure, I can. We're a stakeholder group of 31 members currently, and our goal is to really provide a forum for people to talk about a variety of workforce issues. I think adult basic education is a partner that hasn't had an official seat on the council. They've participated through the Department of Ed. It would make a good member. They've been participating with us. Commissioner McElroy mentioned the Fast Track Initiative that's kind of looking at synthesizing different parts of adult basic education, workforce centers, and addressing the needs of low-income and low-skill workers. That initiative started at the Governor's Workforce Development Council as a planning grant from the Joyce Foundation, and now it resides with DEED to do that. So I guess I see us currently investigating those issues, and we welcomed the recommendation from the OLA to further look at this. We'd be more than happy to bring these parties together to address this specific recommendation.
Well, I'm going to open up to questions, but I'm going to finish by saying that this was not an unknown issue. I mean, it's been there for a while. And the Governor's Workforce Council, with 32 members, knew that it was there. So over the next couple of weeks or months or however, couple of years, however long the session is going to be, I'll have to have some other conversations with you, because I think there's some things that I need as a committee chairman, the council, to do that I don't think it's been have been done in the past. So hopefully you're going to grace my door a couple of times and some. So Representative Norton has a question.
Well, it was just specific to this, and then I'll have other broader questions later. But the Governor's Workforce Council, the work that I've seen from the council recently has actually been in K-12, having to do with the plans for 9th through 12th graders, you know, the graduation plan. So there's already been a lot of work and a big body of work done on that particular issue. So I guess I would have two questions. One is, who appoints these people? It says the Governor's Council, so I assume that the governor makes these appointments. Is that
27 of our members. We have 31 members are appointed by the governor.
Okay, so
there's some ex officio members.
So I would raise just the issue, just because it should be raised, I think. When you have a partisan appointee, I do worry about how generic the look might be. Would the issues that I have be considered in that group when they're all gubernatorial appointees and we're of perhaps not the same mind? So I would be a little concerned.
We voted for GMAC.
Okay. All right. Well, we did.
We do have four legislative members who are from both parties who participate in the council as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, there are some categories provided for that have been helpful. For example, I believe there are four representatives of organized labor to be appointed, a couple of representatives from what we refer to as the community rehabilitation providers, special needs workers or in the workforce system, some named representatives from the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota State College and University System, and there are four state agencies that are directed to have an appointee, the Department of Education, the department, our department, Department of Human Services,
Department of Education.
In Department of Education. And so,
and Commissioner McElroy, I respect that, and frankly, I know some of the appointees that work on there, and they're wonderful people, but they're Republicans. I'm just going to be really honest. So I'm just questioning whether this is an appropriate group or not, just on the partisanship issue, because while I'm not a terribly partisan person, there are others who are. I would also ask my initial my initial comment with, they already have this is a group I don't think that's paid. These are people that get together periodically to do work, and is this asking an awful lot of people who aren't hired and do this as a full-time job if we put this task on them? So that's just a question.
And Commissioner McElroy, if you could forward, or Mr. Lindsay, if you could forward the organizations and that are represented and the names to the committee members, that would be appreciated.
And Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to do that. And I don't think they're all Republicans by any means, by quite a stretch. But we'll find out. And I may not know. We'll give you the names.
Yeah. And Representative Norton, that is a concern. I don't think it's the biggest concern. We golf people want to find a strong workforce, but again, as I said earlier, you know, this is not something that's a new issue. It's been there for a long time, and we haven't dealt with it. So, Representative Haas?
Mr. Chair, could I still, I'm sorry, Representative Haas, but I would like an answer to whether, whether they have the time to do this sort of task. I mean, is a group I really want to know, is this something they can take on in addition to the other things they're doing?
Sorry. Thank you, Representative Norton, Mr. Chairman. The council does achieve a lot of its work through committees. Council members do chair those committees, and we invite lots of different representatives from around the community and a lot of organizations to participate in those. So those groups meet on a monthly basis and really do work over a period of months and years to come up with policy recommendations. Those do go through the council. if that kind of answers your question. But our goal is to really bring in a lot of different perspectives and find where, you know, we can find agreement and put forth good policy recommendations that do address these workforce gaps.
Does that answer your question, Representative Norton?
Mr. Chairman, not exactly. And my experience with the Governor's Workforce Development Council is they are looking for more to do. They welcome a challenge. The when this is presented to them at their next meeting, they will say something like, great, we want more to do. And this issue of trying to either put thinner walls on the silos in these various systems or build more cross augers is one that we've been working on. It is not simple. You know, when we talk about trying to get early childhood education, K-12, adult basic, and community colleges, they wonder, well, are they going to merge us? Are they going to change our funding? Or is it going to change the way we've always done things? And since I was first appointed to this job, I first went out and talked about the silos, and that upset people. And so now I talk about systems and disciplines and finding better ways to get them to work together. And we welcome this if it provides some sense of urgency that we have to break down those barriers. I will share a humorous note. I was at a National Governors Association conference in Washington in which a representative of the Obama administration testified that they no longer have silos in their administration. They now have cylinders of excellence.
Well, Mr. Lindsay, as the director of I take it you're the director of the Governor's Workforce Council. I'm going to ask you, when you have your next meeting and you present this to your board, could you also get back to myself and the other committee members or send it to Ms. Dornfeld a plan to do this? You know, how you go about it, how long it might take, when you could get back to us. I mean, I don't want to put a report date in specifically into law because that's just kind of a process we don't need to do. I just want to know what your thoughts are. Is this a three-month process, a six-month process? What do you think you need to look at and how you go about it? If you could bring that back to us or to Ms. Dornfeld, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Absolutely. We can definitely do that, and I will be in touch with you and your staff soon.
And I see in the statute book they have the list of who's on your committee.
Yes.
But take a look at it and kind of tell us who these people are and from where, not just the way that it is written in the statute, but, you know, what school or where they're from. I think now, Representative Hotz.
Thank you very much. I was just going to comment on the appointments from Central Minnesota to the Workforce Council were done by position and by background and not by political party. So I didn't feel it was political at all. Now, that may be different in different areas. I do not know that. But in the Central Minnesota area, it was very much based on position and background. I did work on this ABE bill last year, and our first attempt was to put adult basic education under higher education, which was a near-death experience for me. So we went then to those four pilot programs of which we're going back. But if I was recalling, I thought we were trying to position an ABE position to the Workforce Council and could not get that done. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, we had encouraged them to apply for a citizen's position. We did get an appointment, but it was from the Minnesota Literacy Council, which is does some work in adult basic education. They also do some work in early childhood. So, yes, their trade association did apply for a position. Tell me the gentleman's name.
Eric Nesheim.
Eric Nesheim, and Eric is serving, and he will be helpful. He represents adult literacy and what they refer to as numeracy, math competency. At our request, he applied for a citizen position and was appointed.
Mr. Chair.
And I'll be real surprised if he's a Republican.
I'm not. This is entrapment.
Don't go there. Just don't go there. I'm just surprised at Representative Norton bringing that one up. That would have been me, but not him.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the evolution of the person going through the ABE process because of a of the number of immigrants now coming into the to our area, that student may look a great deal different than what they did 10 years ago. Some of them speak five languages, none of which was English. Yeah. You know, French as the common language and so forth. So the stress there is much different than it was 10 years ago, and it's evolving, and we do need to get those people trained and into the workforce and education as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Representative Obermiller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thanks for coming in again today, and I know we've been working on UI issues a bunch, unemployment insurance issues a bunch, and I have a couple questions about the report's comments on the call center and the interaction with people. And the report essentially, I think, does a good job of saying what everybody intuitively knows, that if you're talking to someone one-on-one and then you're set and you say, I need some help with this, and they say, go talk to my automated system, that's frustrating for a lot of people. We may not be able to get away from that piece, but I recall that we put some funding in place last year to put, I think it was state money, to put new people in the actual workforce centers to help with this specific issue. And I think we talked a little bit about there being some new people hired there. Could you comment on whether those were new people and how they're funded and whether they're actually doing this work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Obermiller, there are two groups of people that fit that description. One funded from federal stimulus dollars, essentially job seeker services type dollars. I think there are approximately 80 people.
85.
Thank you, 85. And they're working heavily in resource rooms. They're also telephoning people who have applied for unemployment, inviting them in for an orientation. In addition to that, the unemployment insurance program has used dollars, some of which come as a formula because of high workloads and some from stimulus, to hire additional people in a program called reemployment assistance. And they're calling people who have a high likelihood of exhausting because of the industry from which they came or because of having been unemployed previously, and assisting them in doing a reemployment plan. And I believe there are about 25 of the... Thank you.
Mr. Commissioner, Mr. Lindsay, thank you very much. Ms. Elsie, why don't you come on down?
Yes, that's a good idea.
Just yell it out. You know,
well,
can I use
a
lifeline?
Any commissioner who thought they could have all the details in a complex agency, this agency will, between unemployment insurance and the Public Facilities Authority and the various programs, have total expenditures just this year of nearly $4 billion. And if I tried to know it all, you know, I'd be, it wouldn't be humanly possible. So I rely on Ms. Elsie, who has been with the agency for a few years now, since before we had child labor laws, and has these details of Workforce Development Division at her fingertips. But to answer your question, those are helping, but some of them are funded with temporary dollars. And so we are starting, we have a program that starts next week using a process called Lean Office to get the subject matter experts on how things work in resource rooms, workforce development programs, and unemployment insurance, and do a flow chart of the processes and try and find a better way to get these questions answered and connect people. Now, the suggestion made in the audit report is one that I haven't ruled out. They would like us to establish a direct line so that people calling from a workforce center could bypass the automated system. I'm concerned that that creates kind of a two-class system and leads to longer wait times for other people. But if we, the idea of creating a chain, a system where someone in a workforce center would say, let me help you make a call, and you may have to wait. There is a wait, but you will get to a person without having to press the phone tree half a dozen times. That we're working on a way to do that. But rather than have me just say, go do it, I want the people who do job seeker services and unemployment to develop a process. And we're not going to take a lot of time at this. I think the Lean, what they call a Kaizen event, is on March 2nd and 3rd. Mm-hmm. And I got one right. And shortly thereafter, we will try and have a new procedure in place. Now, in a footnote to the report, the legislative auditor staff noted that they understood the concern that it wasn't fair to create a system where if you went to the workforce center, you got in faster than if you just called us. And
thank you, Mr. Commissioner, or Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I want to make sure I understand where the money is coming from. The 85 people that we've identified from federal stimulus money, those folks are they're helping people who are already on unemployment transition into one of the other programs we have. But not helping them get unemployment, I take it.
Mr. Chairman, they can certainly provide some computer assistance, but they're not experts on the unemployment system. They can't answer the detailed question about an account. Their job is to help people get a job. They can get them connected to the people in customer service who can answer the detailed questions. And I should be clear, not everyone who comes into a workforce center is unemployed, but most of them are. Some people come into the workforce center because they're thinking about their next job or they're underemployed, but the majority of the people who come into workforce centers are unemployed.
Mr. Chair, I've got a couple questions about the call center, too, but I see you have a list. If other people want to go first, I'm happy to.
Well, I will call on some other people here. We have a couple other people to bring up, so I'm going to go another 10 minutes, and then we will probably move on to Minskew and then the workforce councils. But I think you're going to get another bite at this apple in Mr. Rukavina's committee. So, Representative Gotwell? Did you have a question? No, okay. Representative Brennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to switch subjects here to the recommendation to transition from direct grants to a competitive grant process. I'm very open to that on a philosophical level, but very concerned about the mechanics of it and what would be required for us to identify in legislation in terms of outcomes or broad directives that might shape the RFPs so that we don't get ourselves in a situation where we are there's a breakdown in continuity of service, thinking about the clients served by these various grant programs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brinert, and Ms. Elsie may have some comments on this one also. As we now understand the auditor's program, or auditor's recommendation, is that it is about three grants for additional service providers in addition to the 16 workforce service areas. It has been going on for some time. Two of them have tight affiliations to organized labor, one to the Teamsters and one to the United Auto Workers, and the other to the Employers Association. Why do they get the grants? It's a tradition. They have gotten them over the last decade or more.
I'm not sure that's the question she was asking.
Well, I think those are the grants that the legislative auditor asked us to make competitive and that we're inclined to do that. The purpose is for additional capacity to serve people who are in small layoffs, in layoffs of 50 or less. And often they were people in employers who were represented by one of these organizations. Not always, but often they were Teamsters or auto workers or employers that belonged to the Employers Association.
If I could stop you, I think you're talking about a pretty specific, and I don't think you're getting to Representative Reinhardt's question. I mean, I think, right. Weren't you asking more of a broader system?
Mr. Chair, that was one aspect of the auditor's recommendation, but the broader aspect of taking those designated grants that we have in law to a range of service providers, who serve youth or certain types of dislocated workers or, targeted populations. How do we move that into a competitive grant process and still meet the outcomes that are desired in terms of the targeted population?
Yeah, and I think to list them were Youth Build, Twin City Rise, Here, Higher, OIC, some of those.
A dozen of those.
Thank you. I misunderstood the question, or at least part of the question. And we have formula programs for some of those areas. For example, the Minnesota Youth Program provides formula dollars, but some communities have felt that they had needs in excess of the formula and came to the legislature. The legislature We're also concerned about taking money out of the Workforce Development Fund that was originally developed to pay principally for the dislocated worker program and directing it to other needs. But we understand that the general fund dollars have been in very short supply for a long time. And when I was chair of this committee, I was guilty of the same thing. We used some dollars for non-dislocated worker programs. As I know will be discussed in the next few weeks, we've now fully allocated the dollars available this year for the dislocated worker program for training, at least. We have dollars for core services, and that's a challenge. However, if it were the will of the legislature to have some additional dollars available for youth services, for example, or for employment for the hard to serve, like Twin City Rise serves, we would suggest that you direct us to create a competitive grant program, tell us what the outcomes are, tell us perhaps to bring the RFP back for your review. My concern is that if we use very many dollars out of the Workforce Development Fund, it reduces the number of people we can serve in the Dislocated Workers Program. We also should build a surplus, in my opinion, in the Dislocated Workers Program during good times so that we have additional dollars to spend during recessions. We have not been able to keep ourselves from transferring money. And
I was just going to say, we all know what happens then, Mr. Commissioner.
Well, we know what has happened, Mr. Chair, and it goes back to the Carlson administration, happened in the Ventura administration, has happened in the Plenty administration, and it very honestly, from my point of view, as Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development, is a mistake, because the times when you have high employment and low unemployment, you should be building a surplus, as we do in the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
Yeah. Did you, I don't want to cut you off, but you were going into a different area. Did you get the answer you were looking for?
Well, broadly in terms of identifying outcomes, but I also think that there'll need to be some dialogue between the population served, DEED, and the legislature in shaping that transition to a competitive process so that, as I said, we don't end up with a discontinuity of service and a failure to reach the populations it's intended to target. I do understand your concern about cutting dollars out of workforce development, and but nevertheless, we've done this over a number of years, and I think if we're going to make a transition, we want to do it at as high a level as possible in terms of that continuity.
And before you answer, is is Jim Rhodes here?
Yep.
Well, why don't you come, Ms. Elsie? I appreciate you coming down. I'm sure you helped him a tremendous amount, but I know admin takes care of the Office of Grants or whatever they call it, and maybe
Mr.
you can
Chairman,
add a little bit to it.
Mr. Chairman, before Mr. Rhodes starts, if I could make one comment.
Please.
For Representative Brainard. It's interesting, we learned this week that the Obama administration budget has additional dollars for workforce development programs through the Department of Labor. And their intention is, rather than to add them to the formula that has been done in the past, to make them competitive grants. And as we have been competing, and fairly successfully, for grants for workforce training in the stimulus bill, we expect to be able to compete for dollars from federal programs to meet specific needs in the future. At least that's if the president's budget passes as he's recommended.
Mr. Rhodes, would you like to comment to Representative Brynett's question?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Jim Rhodes, the legislative director for the Department of Administration. Representative Brynett, can you give me a flavor of what you're trying to get out of the grants issue? Then I would be helpful for me to give a better response.
The auditor's report, yes, recommends we move from direct grants to a competitive process.
Right.
And yeah, so that's the recommendation. Currently, we have targeted dollars that are targeted towards, but I mean, the reason we have direct grants is there are very specific, unique populations that are being targeted, right, with those direct grants. So I have a concern that as we move from the direct grant process to a more competitive, following the recommendation of the auditor, that we do our best to develop the outcomes in a manner that supports continuity of service for those client groups.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, let me give an answer. And just if I make just a couple of remarks. First of all, it's very difficult to follow somebody like Commissioner McElroy, who's extremely articulate and very bright and knows his stuff.
And old.
And old. I'm older than you are. But let me just tell you that, first of all, the Office of Grants Management came, as you know, out of the legislative auditor's report. And our person that started the process is no longer with us. She went to another agency. And I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview, which will capture what you're looking at, if I may have some flexibility, Mr. Chairman. As you know, the OLA's report had us start a grants management office of grants management, and that was in 07. And by the way, we are in the process of filling that position now. And it became clear in the OLA report that the managing of grants had to nonprofits is fragmented and consistent, and state agencies are making grants, and nobody was really following up on it, which is where you're headed for in this question, as well as the legislature is also gives out grants. So the key recommendation was to establish the office, and then they have the authority to formalize and require agencies to follow the best practices. And the they said, now hang with me on this, the legislature should not name grant recipients in law, but allow agencies to select recipients through a competitive process. That's right out of the report. So we got some funds, and we started the grants management office of one person, I might add. And what she did is she started establishing a direction and policy development process. She communicated through a variety of methods with state employees performing grants management activities. And this was done via newsletters, meeting with work groups, and training. In 2009, they had two training sessions, and over 200 state employees attended. So it was really starting to work well. We also reached out to the nonprofit community as well. And we went into got a lean facilitator, and we were able to assist state agencies in granting and streamline their process. So it really worked well. They have implemented 13 policies. And, for example, notices, requests for proposal, criteria for competitive grant review has already been established, use of grant agreements, and making sure the public comments concerning fraud and waste were in state grants. So we are, in that respect, doing that. What I think pertains to your question is, the legislature always likes to give out grants. I mean, that's just part of what we do, or part of what you do now, what I do. And the question is, there's no follow-up to find out what happened with them. And that's why we want to have this office work. And that's why it's important. I might also tell you that in the Heritage Funds, we did get extra money to have a part-time person just manage those, and so that's out. And that money has been coming in and going out very smoothly, and it's been very well done. But we need to have everybody on the same page, and that says, what did you do with the money? Plain talk. And that's kind of where we're coming from. Does that kind of get to what you were talking about?
Well, that helps. You're situating Mr. Chair.
Right ahead.
In a broader context of the whole, the broad recommendations regarding grant management, and the specific recommendations we received the other day related to the workforce program grants. But I do see Representative Norton's legislation of last session relates directly to your issues around evaluation and outcomes. But I think we'll be in dialogue about this as we move forward. I just think as a committee, we would benefit by some thoughtful approach to that transition from direct grants to competitive process.
Representative Hawes, do you have a question?
No, I do not.
Oh, okay. And then Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. to the commissioners, it says in the OLA report that funding that comes is in a direct mix of federal and state resources and things like that. But in the beginning, it says the major findings were that federal laws limit possible changes, and that later on it says the performance measures are inadequate to assess the quality of workforce programs. How well has Minnesota done in regards to what federal funding has allowed us to do as it pertains to other states in the nation dealing with this federal proposal for workforce
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, The concerns expressed are principally about a large federal program called the Workforce Investment Act that does, that is quite specific about a number of areas and limits the flexibility of funding between what they call titles. And that program is in the process of being reauthorized. Ms. Elsie serves actively in the National Association of State Workforce Agencies and along with a number of other groups are trying to work with principally Senate staff at the moment to resolve some of these issues. The Act provides federal performance measures. It doesn't prevent us from having some additional performance measures, which we're working on and working with our partners on. But in the established performance measures, like percentage of people who get a job following training, percentage of people who retain the job for 6 months, and the wage obtained, Minnesota has exceeded the federal requirements and done well nationally. Our Workforce Center partners are finding some of those measures a little harder to meet during this recession than prior to the recession. But on the three core federal measures, we have been among the best performing states in the country. The challenge is there should probably be additional measures and longer tracking, and that's part of what the legislative auditor was calling for. And the federal law doesn't prohibit us from doing that, doesn't provide any money. And the other challenge was that...
Mr. Commissioner, if I could, because we're running a little long here, the report talked about not having the money to do that which you just talked about. Could you, and not right now, could you get to the committee members, myself particularly, some idea of what it would cost out of all those grants to actually track them? I saw in the report that you found in the report that you had to negotiate with those grantees, basically a take back from them so that you could audit them. Well, I think that actually should be in part of the grant writing, some of the legislation, whatever, whether it's 0.25% or 1% of the grant should go to that. That's what I would like to know as a dollar figure that you think it would take and how much. And you don't need to do it right now because I'm going to call down
Mr. Chairman, unless
our esteemed prior colleague,
well,
for those of you who weren't here, Mr. Rhodes used to be on this side at this table.
Yes. Thank you.
So if you could do that for me, Mr. Commissioner, I would appreciate it.
We can, Mr. Chairman.
This is an interesting topic because just briefly, we fund the Grants Management Office by asking people that we actually police to help pay for the job of policing them. And the federal law, we cannot get money. They do not give money for, we can't get a percentage of it. That's the federal. So any federal grant is strictly paid for by state grants, receipts of people that we police. It's kind of like putting an advertisement on a police car. We support you. Here's our ad. But meanwhile, you're still stopping our people. It's the same type of thing. And that's been a problematical thing. The funding is a little difficult in that respect.
Well, and the same to you then, if you could give us some idea of, what it might take, particularly with state grants, because you're correct, we don't have much control over federal grants. So
right.
If you could get that to the committee, I would appreciate that.
We can, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, we will. And right now, we're the only legislature money provided was the one-time funding of $125,000, right. And that's gone now. So that's, we're just operating on the percentages of the state grants.
And we're operating on a shoestring for a while.
Well, I guarantee that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think next on the agenda was Ms. Rothschild from Minsky, and whoever she brought with, apparently.
She brought a college president.
That's right.
So we
there
have
you go.
The central office and the college, too.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Mahoney, members of the committee, I'm Mary Rothschild. I'm with the Office of the Chancellor for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I do have a president of one of our colleges here who can introduce himself.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. I'm Kevin Kapischke, president of Alexandria Technical College.
Thank you for coming in this morning. I'm going to believe that you went through the report, and some of the things in the report said long and short, was that there wasn't, the coordination wasn't as good as it should be. The classes were more geared towards the standard semester type setting. And they didn't, that didn't always serve this population. And the unwritten comments in the report were that the private colleges are just doing a bang-up job of this. And that's great for the private colleges, but frankly, I have to deal with, and I think we as a legislator should deal with the state colleges and state resources. So you want to comment to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We were asked to focus on just two elements of this report. One had to do with the availability of academic programs for dislocated workers, which is your question, and the other has to do, of course, with the co-location of our colleges, the workforce center programs on our college campuses, and we covered that one, I think, at the last hearing pretty well. As to the availability of academic programs, there are several different issues, I think, perspectives that you could take on the availability. One would be the length of the programs and the extent to which people have availability of taking classes that are short-term, that meet their career goals and their occupational outlook. In general, in the system, we have well over 650 short-term academic programs. That would be 1 year or less, about 30 credits or less. That averages to about 20 per college, but that can vary. Our metropolitan area colleges run more in the 30 short-term program lengths, or 30 programs of short-term length. Some of the smaller, more rural colleges would have somewhere in the nature of 13 to 15. So dislocated workers do have many programs that are short-term in length available to them throughout our college and university system. The question as to the start dates is a little trickier. We do have many of our colleges that provide a public set of courses that can be hourly, which would be 1 to 4 weeks, 8 weeks, which would be about a half a semester, to 16 weeks, which would be a semester to a full year. And they fall into many different program areas. Many of them are in the business and management areas where there are jobs in information technology, many healthcare programs from nursing assistant to practical nursing to the medical assisting areas, and information technology, many of the computer networking programs are very short-term in length, as well as a few of the manufacturing areas, machining and welding. But the issue of alternate start dates is challenging to us. We have tried actually to be consistent in having all of our colleges and universities start and end roughly on a semester system so that students who are transferring between or among colleges can start and end programs at the appropriate dates and then continue their education with having lost, without having lost some of those educational experiences. We have various ways where students can access alternative start dates. If a workforce center has a large enough group of people who are interested in starting a cohort and the workforce center wants to pay for that as under a contract, they can do it that way. We also have what's called our Training Resource Center, which is an online matching program between the Workforce Center counselors and our Minnesota State College and University counselors, and they can help match program interest by the dislocated worker to the student. But with that general overview, I'll leave it to President Kopischke perhaps to explain the experience they had at their college about the multiple start dates.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, Kevin Kopischke, Alexandria Technical College. Thanks, Mary. I think at the front end, it needs to be very clear that the working between our workforce centers and our two-year colleges particularly has been very strong, especially the last couple of years when we've experienced the kinds of change in our workforces, in our locales that we have. I think if we look at the growth that we've experienced this past year in enrollments across the system, it's been phenomenal. Much of that growth has come from the fact that we've been working with our workforce centers to get students into the programs. One of the issues that we have is that we're very concerned when dislocated workers come to us that they're ready. They're ready academically. They're ready from a financial perspective. And moving through the financial aid events is sometimes traumatic for these folks. Most importantly, rather than getting them in early and getting them done quickly, we're mostly concerned about getting them in the right program. Mary mentioned the 600-plus one-year or less programs that we have in the system. At Alexandria, we have 30. We have 30 programs that allow students to move through in less than 1 year to be prepared for a particular career. Now, what we're not going to do, and what our advisory committees have told us not to do, and you need to know that those advisory committees are very critical to us, especially at our school, and I believe at all the two-year colleges around the state of Minnesota, they've told us that they want technicians that are ready for the new times that we're facing. They want very high-skilled technicians. You don't develop high-skilled technicians in 3 weeks or 6 weeks. That just isn't going to happen. So if anyone thinks that we're going to have a magic solution that's going to turn a line worker into a mechatronics technician in 6 weeks, it won't happen at our college. It won't happen at any college. So as we start to look at those kinds of things, it's important for us to make sure that we know where these people are when they come to us, so that at the other end, which we're responsible for as well, the retention and the placement and graduation side, we're meeting that responsibility. And my responsibility as a president to the state of Minnesota, to the Minsky board, to everyone here, is to make sure I come in with a balanced budget. And when we have one or two students who would like to start in the middle of a semester, that is nearly impossible for us to do. It simply cannot be done because of a lot of reasons, whether it's lab space or instructional cost, kinds of things that just don't move through the college very well. We have a record 13 technical programs that are full this year at our college. It also means that it's very difficult to get students into some of these programs unless we have room. So again, my comment really began and will end with the fact that the working between our workforce centers and our colleges is extremely successful. Now, do we work to improve it? Absolutely. We work daily. We have a representative of our college at the workforce center on a weekly basis. They have their representatives at our college on a weekly basis as well.
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions before I open it up. One of them is, you know, you come here with a stellar reputation, and your college comes with a stellar reputation. I've, you know, in conversations away from these tables here where the cameras and lights and everything are on, you know, I wish we had, I don't know, what is it, 60 other college presidents that have done some of the things that you've done. My question is a couple of, the one I'll ask is, what have you done to take your day student, and that is one-third, two-thirds, somewhere through the program, gets offered the job, has to make the decision, do I finish, get my certification, or do I take the job and feed my family? How do you transition that student to a night class, to a weekend class? Do you even do that? And then the second part of the question is, Ms. Rothschild, and I'll let you answer that first.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we have a cohort-driven group of programs, and the exact scenario that you've described does happen, but it doesn't happen often at our college. Now, part of the reason might be because we haven't had a lot of layoffs in West Central Minnesota at our college.
Lucky you.
Yeah, we have been fortunate. We have had some. When that happens, we really believe that it's important for that student who may be leaving her or his program to understand the longer-term ramifications. We will work with the employer to make sure that when these courses are offered to allow that student to complete the program, that they get back into college to complete the program. And we found that we've had examples of students who may come to class from 2 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon because that's when one of those missing pieces is offered. Now, in terms of afternoon and weekend, we do some of that, but not a lot. And we don't do a lot of it because we don't simply have the demand as they might have at St. Paul College, where you have a much different demographic moving in and through that institution.
For Ms. Rothschild, what is the system doing to meet that particular need? I know last year, case in point, kids were, that I deal with day in and day out, had difficulty making that transition.
Right.
So if you, could you tell me what the whole system as a whole is doing to make that transition for these students that are getting a job in midstream?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have many programs or courses where people can continue their education through our continuing education and customized training operations in the system. Customized training would be through an employer contract and certainly would be through the identification of specific skills that their company's workforce would need to be improved for the benefit of the firm. But the continuing education is really a very good place for many people to continue their education even after they've obtained a job. And many of those programs are evening or weekend programs. They do focus on very short-term kind of skill certification areas. Probably the best example would be in the information technology area, where you can get industry-based certifications within 3 credits or an hourly basis. The as a system policy, we don't require our colleges and universities to offer a certain number of courses during the nights, evenings, or weekends. But you mentioned the private college system, and I think we do. Our colleges keep fairly close track of the competitive nature of the adult training market. And we do see an increasing number of colleges and universities offering the evening and weekend courses in perhaps more of the upper division and the graduate program area to be competitive with the private colleges. We do have a few examples where we know that employers have worked in the workforce center system have worked very closely together to block courses. Riverland Community College, for example, worked through a contract with Workforce Development, Inc. in the Owatonna and Albert Lee and Austin area. They have a block model for manufacturing skills where they really are able to kind of make small cohorts of people and continue their education. But I would say overall that those are kind of the unique program areas, and they kind of come up when, I think as President Kopischke mentioned, there's more of a demand for it. Than being able to accommodate maybe people on a one- or two-person basis. But we're working on that. I think the online education also offers a very good option for many people to continue their education after they've obtained a job.
Well, Representative Poppy has a question, but I will tell you this particular story. 25 years ago, when I turned out as a journeyman and wanted to increase my skills as a pipe fitter, I had to convince instructors to allow me to come into their class almost on a, I don't know what they call it, audited basis, which was utterly frustrating because I'm trying to become a better, faster, smarter pipe fitter, and the system truly worked against me. And that's 25 years ago, and I will tell you that I've heard from a couple of young people in Minneapolis that basically said, they told me the story, and I could have been listening to myself. So it's still going on 25 years later. There, you know, we move at a glacial pace up here, but that might be a little bit too slow. Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for giving the shout-out to Riverland Community College, because that's my college, so glad to hear about it. I just wanted to ask a question about the readiness piece, because I do work as a college counselor at Riverland, and that is an issue for people to be ready. But I had a question about how often, maybe President Kopischke, do you do a readiness prep part of it? Because I think that that's an issue that, you know, maybe if it's only offered in you know, at a certain time, then that kind of delays a start, and I'm just curious about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, the readiness side can be done almost as needed through our special needs and support services mechanism at the college, which is a component of the college that assists students that need some catch-up work or need some developmental work. It may depend on the severity of the readiness side. If we have someone, for instance, interested in a diesel mechanics program, and she or he scores a 12 on the mechanical reasoning test, we've got a serious problem. And in that particular case, we might want to suggest that maybe they consider some of the other programs, and then we move them through a career assessment and a career planning initiative that I'm sure you're well familiar with. Mm-hmm. But the readiness side is not a major problem for us. Now, what it might mean, though, is that we aren't going to be able to spend just 2 weeks to get you ready and then jump in the middle of the semester. It might still mean that we won't get that person into that particular course or program until the next semester.
Mr. Chair, do you have fall start, spring start, summer start for all of your technical programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, for most. Now, what we will find is that we may not get them into the exact sequence of the machine tool technology course, but we might be able to get them into some of the CORD courses that we have that are going to be required of them later on. So we might get them into two CORD courses and maybe a general education course, 9 credits or 12 credits, and then the next semester get them started with the regular sequence of the course. We do not have all of our programs, all of our 48 program sequenced so that you can begin the complete program every semester. We don't have the numbers to do that.
And I think I have just a couple more questions, but I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. In addition to the academic readiness, and you also talked about the financial readiness, and I'm just curious about any attempts made to have a coordination with the Workforce Center, for instance, or with the dollars that come in to be able to provide for the financial ability for a student to take, for instance, maybe the developmental courses or the prep work, and how that's working.
Chair Mahoney, Representative Poppe, let me begin by saying that we have seen a very large increase in the number of students receiving Pell Grants this year. I'm not an expert in student financial aid, but we have worked very closely with the Workforce Center system to publicize for students, dislocated workers, the availability of Pell Grants. And while we can't attribute precisely, I would guess, that increase to all dislocated workers, I think between the increase in enrollment and the increase in the number of students receiving Pell Grants, we can assume that many people are getting their financial needs met through the kind of traditional Pell Grant opportunities.
Mr. Chair, what about those either who are not eligible for Pell Grant or even just, I know that at our college, you know, there's a deadline. If you don't have your financial aid completed, you kind of miss out for at least that semester. So I'm just wondering about, again, a collective conversation between the Workforce Center and the college to be able to say, okay, if these people are coming in, we're going to be able to provide this, and somebody has some funds somewhere in order to be able to fund it. Is that happening? Is that possible?
Well, I think in addition to the traditional student financial aid, many of the Workforce Center clients will come in with funding through the eligibility to take WIA certified courses. It might be a better question for someone from the Workforce Center system to answer specifically how those funds are received by the individual who has gone through the appropriate process at the Workforce Center to be eligible for reimbursement of a WIA certified course. And we do understand that the number of WIA certified courses has increased, as well as there's been greater flexibility about both credit and non-credit courses being eligible for that reimbursement of their financial aid or financial assistance, I guess, not specifically the way we think of financial aid.
And Mr. Chair, just one more question, if I could.
That's, yeah.
Okay, I just have a quick question about the sharing of programs. And I know that at a smaller community college or technical college, it might be difficult to be able to respond quickly and to be able to have you know, bring something from the early stages on to a stage of being able to then offer it. And I'm just wondering about the possibility of sharing programs and how you are within the system, Minsky system, of being allowed to, if you have something at Alec Tech, if you're able to then replicate that somewhere else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, that's a great question, and it really is going to define, I think, the kinds of things that are in our future. Because I really believe that as we look at the fiscal 12 and 13 biennium, there will definitely need to be some changes made in terms of how we offer these things. One of the examples of what we're doing right now is in our mechatronics program, where our mechatronics program is connected with seven high schools around the state, including Owatonna in your area, that allows our mechatronics faculty to work with faculty in these high schools and eventually our technical colleges to deliver core-level mechatronics type of training. It can help the faculty member get up to speed with what she or he is involved with, and it can give high school students an opportunity to become familiar with the kind of work that might be involved in the mechatronics field. The other component of that then moves to the college. We're involved with a very similar type of partnership with Winona, Southeast Tech in Winona, where they took a look at the development of a mechatronics program, understood that it was a very high-cost program, decided that they weren't going to get involved with it, so they're working with us now to deliver, again, the core components of that mechatronics program to their college. We're in the early stages of that, but I can tell you that the system is very interested in taking a look at how that works. Now, it's very difficult to make it work geographically if I'm coming to Albert Lea, but the advent of online and other types of WebEx-type learning opportunities make some of this possible, whereas maybe even 3 to 5 years ago, it just wasn't possible. So that is certainly one of the things on our to-do lists to expand capacity and opportunity for those programs that may not be everywhere, because frankly, we aren't going to be able to offer everything to everybody. That's just the way it's going to be.
Thank you, President Poppe. Representative Anderson, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says in the OLA report that the Minsky system should identify academic programs that help laid off workers and assist its college to determine whether to offer more of such programs. And then in the summary, it talks about the deed commissioner saying that they agree that they need to work more closely with the adult basic education and the Minsky system. I wonder, is there a reverse in that situation? Is Minsky willing to work with the ABE? And if Mr. Representative Mahoney said 25 years ago, he was in a situation where he was fighting the education system then, and we're still, from what you just said, we're still fighting it now. What's causing the delay of 25 years of reaching across between agencies to come up with, is it these silos that were mentioned, or these cylindrical cylinders that were mentioned that were, because they're pots of money that we only going to go to certain people and we can't integrate, or is it the law that says you can't mix this dollar and this dollar, or is it the state that's doing it? What is it that's causing us not to get together?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would say that the collaboration and communication among the Workforce Center staff and our college and university staff and ABE has really improved in the last probably 2 years. And we talked earlier about the Joyce Foundation grant, which funded initially pilot projects to bring those three organizations together to really tackle, starting with real life experience. They took academic programs, remedial education, ABE curriculum, and workforce center systems, and used the pilot projects to learn what was working and what was not working. From there, the next step, and Commissioner McElroy didn't mention this, are the policy changes. What are the avenues in policy that can help individuals move through that system? You may have heard a terminology, stackable credentials, meaning certifying what people learn in, say, ABE, making clear that that is college-ready kind of material, going to the college, certifying that that is college-ready through those remedial courses if they're needed in certain areas, and then continuing on to college-level courses. I wanted to give an example of where we think this is working very well. North Hennepin Community College and the Osseo Adult Basic Education have a new program to prepare learners for this college-level work. And what they found, you know, they're trying to strengthen reading and writing. They learn study skills. They explore careers all through this collaboration. And 65% of these college prep students, college prep is the type, the program name, continue to move on into college courses. So we think that between these pilot projects that are funded by the Joyce Foundation and then the policy work, which is being clear about what should be in our funding streams or written in our Minnesota State College and University policies or the Minnesota Department of Education or DEED, we think that we can get to what you're looking for. You know, I do have many different examples of where we're providing some of these short-term courses, career guidance, credit for prior learning. And if Mr. Chair, if you would allow me to, I'd like to provide to the committee, again, some of these examples that we're seeing in some of our colleges. They're very unique. They're very successful. They are not systemic necessarily at this point, but that's what we're working toward through some of these projects. So if I could share those with the committee, I'd appreciate the opportunity.
I would love to have you share those. Are you talking about sharing them right now or later?
I could provide them in writing. I know we're short of time, so we could provide them to the committee in writing.
Well, thank you. I'm going to did you have a follow-up?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair.
And why don't we have the – while you're making the comment, can I have the workforce people start coming down?
Sure.
Thank you.
The comment is that this happened – the same thing that we're looking at today was here in 1995 when I first took office. So I'm really, as Representative Mahoney said, wondering what in the world is causing all the who's delaying this thing, because I think from the president here giving his example at the technical college, I went to the Wilmer Technical College, found fantastic results there. I have a son that went to Bethel University. They mentor their people, and they have a work program that's instituted in their program, and they go on site and work. I don't know why that can't work in regular colleges, too.
Well, and to that, just to that point, I mean, the difference is a Bethel College versus a state college is typically tuition costs. And I will give credit to our public system versus our private system. The tuition numbers are eye-opening.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that system, though, if it's taken 25 years to come to that conclusion, we've really fallen down in our.
we've beaten up on Minskew on dollar figures. So if the workforces could come up.
Thank you.
Representative Gottwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the meantime, I've been listening with great interest. You know that one of the differences between our private colleges and our public colleges is we don't give $1 billion to our private colleges. I by the way, am experiencing, Mr. Chair and members, the sticker shock of trying to shop for both our public colleges and our private colleges in the state of Minnesota for my latest kid to go off to college, and it is shocking. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I'm done with that.
good for you. But, yeah, it does puzzle me sometimes. You know, we've got Minskew. We didn't have that, 15, 20 years ago. But, we to find some more coordination and some more alignment with the needs in the workforce, I think, shouldn't take 25 years or however long Representative Anderson has been here. So I think it's certainly an issue worth pursuing.
Thank you. To the workforce centers, maybe you could comment about what was the question that you had about coordinate? Identify yourself for the tape, and I'll let Representative Poppy ask her question again.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Vetsen, and I'm the director of the Anoka County Workforce Area.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had was just about the efforts made for people coming through the doors of the college wanting to be able to get either academic readiness or get into a program, and what kind of financial arrangement has been made between the Workforce Center and the college to be able to allow that person to be able to begin quickly, even if they haven't had their financial aid arranged.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, probably the key thing that shows the importance of adult basic education, coordinating with the colleges, coordinating with the workforce centers, And I have to say, in our workforce area, I think that cooperation is outstanding. And I think it is in many areas, but not all areas. But for the most part, for someone that's coming that's low academic level, we're probably going to recommend some period of time working on the basic skills to get them to the right level so that they can enter school. It's usually through the ABE. If it's just small remediation, typically the colleges have classes where they can work on those remediation issues. Again, we use our ABE center. It's located in our workforce center. And they do, when we test people to go to school, we're looking at that, and they begin working right away through the ABE on getting those skills up. So we have a procedure to do that. I think most areas do something similar.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just again, how about then the person comes in, they've got their readiness done, and they're going into a program. Is there a good coordination, or is there money that allows for a student to be able to have some of their payment made on behalf of them through the Workforce Center?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, yes, there is if there's funds available to do it. And up until 2 weeks ago, I could have said we had money in Anoka County. Today I cannot. We have run out of dislocated worker money in 13 of the workforce areas of the state. The adult programs are pretty much in the same shape in terms of resources. Now, we got some good resources from the legislature last year, some additional. We got good federal, but that money is out, and probably a bigger concern for next year, because to go to school, it's typically not a two-month, six-month proposition. It's a year, 2 years. We have huge tails into next year in terms of commitments for training for people that are in. And in my area, my best assessment right now is that I will put nobody new in school for a year and a half. That's my best guess, unless I get federal or state help to do that for a dislocated work program.
Doesn't bode well for tomorrow, does it?
Does not. But we are working. We're working with the federal government in particular to make additional resources available for dislocated workers in Minnesota. And I think we have a shot at getting some of it. I don't think all of it, but we're working on that. I might just mention a couple of things about the vocational. I think in talking to my colleagues, probably the biggest issue right now for dislocated workers is start times. And that was recommended. Most schools are really going out of their way to help us with this. They're doing extra cohorts of people. They're trying to have starts different times of the year. You know, if the system could move as much as it can, given what limited resources they have, to starts in fall, spring, winter, and summer, those three periods of time, that's critical, because that gives you about a month, within a month or two or three, you can get into a program. That's probably going to be good enough. It used to be better because we used to have quarter systems. But when the system merged, you know, it became more like four-year colleges, and they wanted to match those up. So if they could do that, that would be very helpful. The idea of the shorter programs, I think schools are really working on that in terms of you see a lot of programs that have kind of a one-year possibility and then more a liberal arts two-year degree. They seem to do that, but that's real important for dislocated workers to get into that vocational piece of it right away. And then what you talked about, going to evening school or kind of picking that other stuff up as you work, would be a nice situation. One of the other things that was mentioned was the, you know, what about, we do have a problem with people in adult basic education get frustrated because they're working on their basic skills. It takes a lot of time to do that. There are many people in the adult world who probably are capable of doing some of the vocational stuff while they do ABE. It's a little easier to do that if you do them together. It kind of keeps their spirits up and they get that vocational training. Our system used to be much better at that, the vocational schools, but you know, that system is a bit academic. That's the direction, you know, that the system moves in. And I must say, 25 years ago when I went to school, vocational education was free. Mm-hmm. And it was centered for people that weren't academically oriented. We've gotten totally away from that. And I think that's something that we need to look at again, is we got to rethink that. And that required a lot of resources to do that. Essentially, we said if you couldn't go to a four-year college, you ought to go to some college. And we were careful that meant everybody. It wasn't just bright people that went to two-year colleges or technical schools. It was also people who had not strong academic skills that went to colleges. And we've kind of moved away from that. We've kind of lost track of those folks in terms of our higher education system, I think. the vocational schools do the best job of doing that. But the other part of that is we, I think, need to think about our community colleges and technical colleges as places that are going to be serving people that need remediation. You know, it's like 55 or 60% need. I don't recall exactly what the number is. But at some point in time, we got to start considering that, that they're the institutions that are serving those groups. And they need resources to deal with those remedial issues. And we need to tie AB into that. And we can do a better job of bringing those two together. But frankly, the institutions and the states have done a good job with that, are putting a lot of money into that combined remediation while you do vocational. And it's a lot more expensive than taking someone who's got the academic standard and putting them through a college.
I see no other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If I could just, if the committee would indulge me, if Mr. Nelson could come down for a moment. you see, I scheduled this question when we only have 2 minutes left, so you've got to condense your answer. Is there a way that...
Condense my answer.
Even they laugh.
yeah, even your colleagues
what
laugh.
What do they do? What do they do?
How do we get unemployed people into school and keep them there while they're on unemployment? Can it be done? And how would you do it? 2 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Mr. Nelson.
I would build on what the chair did last year, expand upon what the chair did last year. I think that could be done. A broader definition of what we call approved training or reemployment assistance training. I think an expanded definition would then exempt people from the requirement of being otherwise available for work and actively seeking work, and we could expand that definition. I think the chair did a heroic job, if you will, moving legislation last year, and that could even go further and expand the definition.
And would we, just quickly, would we fall into problems with federal regulations or anything with that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no. Federal law is very broad. States are allowed to decide for themselves what constitutes reemployment assistance training, and I think a broader definition could well suit better the workforce's needs.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. I guess I have one more meeting to make. Members, it's noon. I'm going to adjourn this, but this has been a great discussion. I hope people are thinking about how we can make a better workforce system and its coordination. And again, I want to thank the auditor. I know you came today thinking that you might be having some answers to give, but you lucked out or you may be disappointed. But thank you again. This has been a great, great report. I want to thank you all. Members, the committee is adjourned.